Hello. Welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, November 2nd, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Eleanor Amorosi, Cynthia Baker, known as Joy, Norman Victor Balderrama, Cheryl Lynn Cortez, Mikkel Floyd Currier, Joyce Daly, Marvin Elroy, Harry Gordon, Linda Joan Gustafson, Roger Brent Hall, Matthew James Horn, Linda Ann Jones, Jeffrey Mark Masick, Roxana E. McIlwee, Danny Ray Poff, Mildred Moselle Sherman, Anne Marie Thorne, Sharon Elsie Mildred Waller. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. Our first article is entitled, "As DEI Programs Ebb, White Males Making Gains in U.S. Boardrooms." This was written by Jessica Gein for the USA Today. Following the national uprising over the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, corporations sought out more women and people of color to diversify their boards of directors. For a time, the once ironclad dominance of men, especially white men, in the corporate boardroom appeared to be slipping. Over the last 5 years, racial and ethnic representation rose 20%, and female representation 18% in companies included in the Russell 3000 Index, according to data and the analytics firm ISS Corporate. The boardrooms of the nation's largest companies have never been more diverse, but recent data shows that the diversity, equity, and inclusion backlash is shifting boardroom demographics once again. This year, women accounted for a third of new board hires in the S&P 500. That's down from a high of 44% in 2022. Executives of color made up 19% of the new board hires, which is down from 44% in 2021. White men were a majority of new director hires for the first time since 2017. These top leadership posts confer prestige, power, and a big paycheck. Joelle Emerson, CEO of culture and inclusion platform Paradigm Strategy, said, quote, "This seems to be part of the broader pendulum swift away from a focus on diversity that we have seen over the past couple of years in corporate America," unquote. The shift comes as President Donald Trump's heightened scrutiny of DEI initiatives spreads across the private sector. With fear rising over losing federal contracts or facing investigations, corporations have rolled back or dismantled diversity programs. Some 69% of U.S. adults say it is important for businesses to promote DEI. That's down from 84% in 2022. That's the lowest ebb since tracking began. Emerson said, quote, "A lot of the reason that boards increased representing over a multi-year period was external pressure, and that does not exist anymore," unquote. So as they navigate the tricky political and economic waters, fewer boards plan to add women and people of color to their boardrooms this year, accounting and advisory firm PwC said in a recent report. The percentage of corporate directors who said their boards were planning to add gender diversity fell from 21% to 9% in 2024. Just 6% of directors said that their boards planned to add racial or ethnic diversity. That's down from 13%. The potential slowdown risks eroding hard-fought gains for black Americans in the workplace as boards revert to narrow specs when considering new directors, according to Barry Lawson Williams, who's a corporate executive who has served on more than a dozen boards. Tarang Amin, chairman and CEO of Elf Beauty, is swimming against the tide. He says his is one of a handful of publicly traded companies whose board of directors is 67% female and 44% diverse. He told CNN in a recent interview, quote, "We're very clear. We believe it is a competitive advantage to have a team that reflects the communities we serve," unquote. And that was the article, "As DEI Programs Ebb, White Males Making Gains in U.S. Boardrooms." Our second article from the economy section, "Users Can Soon Use PayPal with ChatGPT." This was written by Manya Saini for the Reuters News Group. PayPal said on October 28th that it has entered into a deal with OpenAI that will allow ChatGPT users to buy products using the payments firm's platform. The company also raised its profit forecast for the year again, banking on resilient consumer spending. PayPal said the OpenAI partnership will connect its global merchant network to ChatGPT, enabling businesses to sell products and services within the widely popular generative AI app that has more than 800 million weekly active users. AI shopping tools are emerging as the next big shift in online retail, as they can autonomously research, compare, and purchase products for consumers. These tools act as digital assistants by understanding user preferences and setting budgets and evaluating reviews and tracking prices over time. Analyst at Evercore ISI said this, quote, "Agentic commerce is seen by some as a potential silver bullet to leverage PayPal's large and global user base and reignite growth on what could be to be proven, as it's still very early days, a next-gen commerce platform," unquote. Well, PayPal said the integration of its platform with OpenAI will make millions of products discoverable and purchasable through ChatGPT. The CEO, Alex Chriss, said in a call with analysts, quote, "We want PayPal to be available anywhere and everywhere the consumers want to pay, and we want merchants to be able to sell to consumers anywhere and everywhere," unquote. Well, once a pandemic-era favorite, PayPal experienced a downturn as consumers returned to the physical stores and the spending patterns stabilized, prompting the company to focus on high-margin businesses and cost-cutting. And that was the article, "Users Can Soon Use PayPal with ChatGPT." Our third article from the economy section, "Walmart Adding Shopping Plazas to Retail Portfolio," by Malina Khan for the USA Today. Walmart has purchased a shopping center in Connecticut for $44 million. The latest instance of the retail giant buying not just the property on which a singular store can be built, but the surrounding property as well. The company now owns the Walmart Center in Norwalk, Connecticut. That's about 50 miles from New York City. Now, while Walmart already has a store at the plaza, it now owns the full strip, which includes retailers like Ulta, Panera Bread, Qdoba, Royal Properties, Inc. That's the firm that represented the seller in a news release. Their statement read, quote, "The amount of interest in this center was substantial. With several options to consider, Walmart stepped up with the best overall offer," unquote. That's from Jeff Kinzer, who is the principal of Royal Properties, in a statement. The company's latest purchase is not its first shopping mall acquisition this year. It closed deals on two plazas in January and May, respectively. In January, the company confirmed to multiple outlets that it purchased the Monroeville Mall in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. Now, unlike the Norwalk Center, Walmart does not have an existing store in that shopping plaza. According to a statement shared with multiple outlets, Walmart said, quote, "It is very interested in being part of any future development," unquote, of the mall. CBL Properties, the firm that oversaw the sale, said the deal was worth $34 million. And then in May, Walmart purchased the Bethel Park Shopping Center in Bethel Park, Pennsylvania, for $39.6 million. The retailer already has a store in the Strip, similar to the Norwalk Center. Walmart did not comment on the new real estate acquisition when contacted by USA Today. Retail experts told USA Today that Walmart's acquisition of shopping centers presents more than just an economic investment. It is also a strategic approach to managing customers' full shopping experience. In owning a shopping center, Walmart can oversee the facilities on the site, which is a key part of the shopping experience, according to Deborah Weinswig, who is CEO of the retail research firm CoreSight Research. Deborah said, quote, "The whole thing is a customer journey. The customer journey, it starts in the parking lot. And actually, right now, because of where we are with buy online, pick up in store, sometimes the only thing you do is go in the parking lot," unquote. John Rawson, an adjunct professor of economics at the University of New Haven, emphasized that Walmart wants to improve the full customer experience of shopping at their store, from its parking lot to which stores are nearby. Rawson said, quote, "If they can, then all of a sudden they are making tons of money, right? They're bringing people into the stores and they're making real estate profits. They're charging rent to the other people in the mall," unquote. Well, as a landlord, Walmart can also have an edge in managing the other retailers in the centers that it owns. So while Walmart has not revealed plans for the Norwalk and Bethel Park centers, it has indicated a desire to demolish the Monroeville Mall. And that was the article, "Walmart Adding Shopping Plazas to Retail Portfolio." And those were the three articles in the section of the paper called The Arizona Economy. We're coming up on 13 minutes past the hour, so we need to move on over to the sports section. Well, from the front cover of the sports section, it's entitled Dawn of the Sun Devils. And it's got a picture of two coaches. And then it relates to the two articles just inside the cover. One of them is Transfer Odom Looking to Lead ASU to Better Season, and that's all about Arizona State men's basketball. The other article is ASU Playing with Renewed Energy as Miller Era Starts, and that's an article about Arizona State women's basketball. So the main parts of the sports section today are all about Arizona basketball. We're going to start with Transfer Odom Looking to Lead ASU to Better Season. This was written by Michelle Gardner for the Arizona Republic. Like Hurley in his playing days, Odom is a point guard. One of Odom's mentors, Halise Cook, played for Hurley's father, the legendary Bob Sr., at St. Anthony. Cook played college basketball in the Pac-12 at Oregon State and in the Big 12 at Iowa State. So there were good vibes from the very start. Odom said, quote, "I feel like he's just one of me, like we grew up together. Maybe it's the East Coast thing, but I think we're always have been on the same page," unquote. Well, the Sun Devils open the new season on Tuesday, November 4th, against Southern Utah, at 7 p.m. at Desert Financial Arena. Odom is a transfer from Pepperdine. He's one of 15 new players on the roster, the lone holdover being 6'3" sophomore guard Trevor Best. Seven of these newcomers are international players. Among those is sophomore guard Noah Meusen, a native of Belgium, who represented ASU at Big 12 Media Day, along with Hurley and Odom. The others are 7'1" freshman center Massamba Diop from Senegal, junior forward Andrija Grabovic from Montenegro, freshman forward Jovan Isidovic from Serbia, senior forward Alan Mukiba from Belgium, 7'1" freshman center Dame Salane from Italy, and sophomore forward Santiago Truet from Argentina. Now Odom, who is 22, comes to ASU after one season at Pepperdine and two at the University of the Pacific. Last season, he averaged 13.1 points per game, 3.2 rebounds, and 7.5 assists, and he also shot 45.2% from the field. Well, the Waves advanced to the West Coast Conference semifinals, with Odom tallying 86 points, 37 assists, and 15 rebounds in his team's four tournament games. Hurley said of Odom, quote, "I watched a lot of film. I really liked his game. I liked the way he carried himself, just his whole personality. I thought he was a good fit for what we needed this season," unquote. Well, Odom is one of the first pieces of the puzzle that Hurley landed during a busy offseason. Everything starts with having a competent player at point guard, so finding the right fit was vital. Hurley had success last year in bringing in the since-graduated Alston Mason, who was ASU's best and most consistent player. Odom has a similar background, moving from a mid-major and wanting to showcase his talent on a bigger stage. Hurley said, quote, "The first thing we did was identify a point guard. Losing Alston Mason, who had a really good year for us, we wanted to make sure we didn't miss a beat. Finding Mo very early in the cycle kind of was the foundation for us building out from there. And then we went in a little bit different direction with the roster. We went pretty heavy with international players," unquote. Well, on stage at the media day at the T-Mobile Center in Kansas City, Odom said he had always wanted to play for Arizona State. Asked to elaborate later in the day, Odom said he played in a tournament during high school held in Phoenix, and his team stayed at a resort in Tempe near the ASU campus. It was his first time visiting Arizona, and he loved it. He said, quote, "I always said if I ever had a chance to come here, the coach didn't know this, but I was going to come regardless. I just needed him to call me. This has been my dream school since high school. So I always told myself if I had a chance to attend ASU, I would. I am excited about this opportunity," unquote. Well, the Sun Devils are looking to bounce back from two straight losing seasons. The team was 13-20 overall, with a 4-16 record in Big 12 play last season. Injuries were a significant factor, and already the Sun Devils have been dealt a blow as junior guard V.J. Wallace went down with what appears to be a season-ending lower leg injury in an exhibition game against Texas A&M on October 26th. Several players who've been dealing with injuries were held out of that contest. Odom, one of the first off-season additions to the program, had 5 points, but took just 6 shots. He had 6 assists and 2 steals in 26 minutes in a competitive 95-88 loss. He didn't have any problem committing, even though he wasn't sure what talent would surround him. Part of that just comes from being a pass-first point guard who makes teammates eager to play with him. Now, Odom has 2 younger siblings in whom he has always taken pride looking after and caring for. He says he will embrace his new teammates the same way. There is also a challenge because there are so many players from other countries with varying levels of experience. Odom said, quote, "It's been fun, it hasn't been easy, but it hasn't been hard either. I grew up with 2 younger siblings, so I learned how to be unselfish because of them and having to care for them. I feel like it translates to basketball. I consider myself an unselfish player, and other guys usually want to come play for a team with a point guard that has that mindset. I figured once I got here, everything would fall into place. And that was the article, Transfer Odom Looking to Lead ASU to Better Season. Now, our second article about Sun Devils is about Arizona State women's basketball. ASU playing with renewed energy as Miller era starts. This was written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. Arizona State women's basketball has some buzz surrounding the program with new head coach Molly Miller. But the Sun Devils will have to do a lot to prove themselves in the Big 12. Last season, 7 Big 12 teams advanced to the postseason, with TCU reaching the Elite Eight. Now, ahead of this season, ASU was picked 11th in the conference preseason poll, with TCU pegged first, followed by Iowa State, Baylor, Oklahoma State, and West Virginia. The assessment isn't the most accurate measurement, as it is based on last season's successes, and it cannot predict the off-season changes. ASU is vastly different from last season, with just 4 returners on the team, 2 of whom were starters. Miller had to hit the portal hard after being hired in March and intentionally went after experienced players while also adding younger players looking to develop more, like forwards Hilosia Carrera and McKenna Brackens. The Sun Devils have a national champion in 5th year, Tier Poa, who won with ALSU in 2023. When Poa, that's P-O-A, entered the transfer portal, she wanted to see which coach was the most consistent in their messaging and goals. Quote, Molly was the main one contacting me every day, texting me every day, and I was like, yeah, I want to play for her, unquote, Poa said. Well, ASU has 7 players who are reaching the end of their college careers. 5th-year guard Gabby Elliott was drawn to join a program where everyone is aligned about their goals. The group also understands that they could reset the program, which was once strong under head coach Charlie Turner Thorne, but hasn't made the NCAA tournament since 2019. Elliott said, quote, everybody's trying to fight for something and leave with something. It's the best with most of us being seniors. We get it. Everybody wants to do something special and leave a place better than they found it. So it's the perfect mix of playing with your teammates and getting to leave with them too, unquote. And with an energetic coach in Miller who transformed Grand Canyon into a tournament team in 5 years, there is excitement. One of the most promising signs of Miller taking over the program was ASU defeating USC 78-76 in a secret scrimmage on October 26th, nearly 2 weeks from the home opener on Monday, November 3rd, which will be against Copper State. Per ON3, Carrera and Elliott stood out in the scrimmage for ASU. Now, the final score didn't show everything that went into that performance. In a previous scrimmage, ASU did not have the right effort against Northern Arizona on the road, but Miller then gave them a lesson. Miller said, quote, I'm never going to walk away from any game or any practice saying that we could have played harder. That was our longest and toughest practice of the year, and I think that carried over into our next scrimmage and our next practices after that. It's just a staple of ours. I cannot let them cut corners or let them do anything but their best. That was a good moment and a learning lesson for us. I don't care what it says on the front or back of the jersey of who you're playing. Our brand is always going to be play tough and play hard, unquote. Now, Miller prides herself on her defense and has been implementing her principles throughout the offseason. Several players have told her that her fast-paced style of play has put them in the best shape of their lives. It is what propelled GCU to the top in their conference. Miller's GCU team had the best scoring defense in the Western Athletic Conference in 2024, allowing just 57 points per game. ASU struggled in its first year in the Big 12 and allowed the most points with 76 points per game. Pitt transfer Marley Washenitz was drawn to Miller's program because she is a defensive-minded player. ASU has worked on being collectively aggressive on every play, whether it is in practices or in scrimmages. Washenitz said, quote, "If you're going to mess up going hard and give it 100%. That's all she asked for. We understand no one is perfect here, so as long as you're going hard and you're playing and trying, you're doing the little things like boxing out and diving for loose balls." She has a saying that every 50-50 loose ball is 100% ours. So we try to continue that every day on the court, unquote. Well, the chemistry came quickly for ASU, even with a newer team. The coaching staff has used the scrimmages to play with matchups and rotations, but likely they won't settle on a specific rotation until later in the season. However, the improvement from the NAU scrimmage to the USC scrimmage has taught Miller a lot about her team. Miller said, quote, "They can play hard, and they will play hard, and they're learning the brand. Winning is tough. Sustaining that for 40 minutes is tough. And then sustaining that for a non-conference season and a whole year is tough. So it was just changing their thinking and behaviors to what the winning behavior looks like," unquote. Well, from the interior of the sports section, we have this article, "Can Murray Salvage Card's Season?" This was written by Bob McManaman for the Arizona Republic. So here is what Bob McManaman wrote. "Murray's record at AT&T Stadium does not mean that he is invincible. Cowboys coach Brian Schottenheimer noted that it won't be a factor in the outcome, and he wasn't planning on even bringing it up to his team. During a news conference on Tuesday, October 28th, he said, 'No, I don't think so. Hopefully it means he's due to lose one.' Well, after missing the past two games because of a midfoot sprain, it could be a defining moment for Murray. The Cardinals have lost five consecutive games, and they need a win in the worst of ways. Murray has been anything but a superhero midway through his seventh NFL season, and if he can't save the day in this game, it will fuel further speculation that his time in Arizona is nearing an end. If it feels as if the entire weight of the Cardinals franchise is resting on Murray's shoulders, it is because it is. They drafted him with the number one overall pick in 2019 to rescue them from losing seasons and lift them to new heights. Instead, they have been incredibly average and have been to the playoffs just once. A franchise quarterback is supposed to deliver, and when he is given time and still doesn't get it done, it usually leads to a change of scenery. Although reaching the playoffs now appears impossible, there is still time for Murray to salvage what's left of the 2025 season and perhaps his future with the Cardinals beyond this year. But it starts with beating the Cowboys on Monday night. Fair or not, he must take it upon himself to stop the bleeding and rescue this team from its five-game freefall." The Cardinals and their head coach, Jonathan Gannon, keep reminding us they have been in every game and just have not been able to finish. Losing five in a row by a total of 13 points is proof. Now that he is expected back in the starting lineup, Murray has no choice but to deliver. Offensive coordinator Drew Petzing, who's been on the hot seat himself, predicts that his embattled quarterback will ignite the Cardinals' offense just as veteran backup Jacoby Brissett managed to do during Murray's two-game absence before the bye. The playmaking ability, the arm talent, the ability to make plays off schedule, I think it makes us dynamic. That's what Petzing said of Murray on Wednesday, October 29th. Well, dynamic would be nice. At this point, the Cardinals fans would settle for simply efficient. Anything that leads to a victory will do. A 3-5 record is much easier to stomach than 2-6. And if Murray keeps his record perfect at AT&T Stadium, he can't stop there. If he expects to resurrect his tenure in Arizona and re-energize a deflated fan base, Murray might really need to turn into Superman and find a way to author one of the NFL's biggest comeback stories. Will it happen? Probably not. But what if he were able to somehow pull it off? Just imagine it for a moment. Beat the Cowboys, and then do the same to the Seahawks in Seattle. Come back to State Farm Stadium and beat the 49ers and the Jaguars. Find a way to win on the road against the Buccaneers and at home against the Rams. And suddenly, at 8-5, the Cardinals would be in the playoff hunt with 4 games left to play. That's how legends are made. Now, in Murray's case, his legacy will be remembered mostly for his glory days back in high school, where he went 43 and zip. That's enough to live on if that's as far as your football career goes. But for Murray, the expectations have always been much higher. He said he came to the Cardinals to win Super Bowls. So far, we've seen more Clark Kent out of Murray than Superman. But oh yes, he was the man back at Allen High. Schottenheimer said, quote, obviously you can't speak about Kyler Murray without talking about what an incredible player he was at Allen. He was one of maybe the greatest high school quarterbacks of all time. You would hear his name, this kid from Allen, Texas, unquote. Well, it's up to Murray if he wants to be known for more than just that. And that was the article by Bob McManaman entitled, Can Murray Salvage Cards Season? Well, we're at 32 minutes past the hour. It's time for us to go find some opinion pieces to read. Our first opinion piece is written by Raina Montoya. It's entitled, When Migration, Grief, and Culture Meet. Now, Raina is the CEO and board chair of Aliento. A-L-I-E-N-T-O. They serve students, dreamers, and immigrant families in Arizona. This is what she wrote, When Migration, Grief, and Culture Meet. Since October, marigolds have been appearing across Arizona. Their bright yellow and orange colors bring a sense of light and hope in the midst of grief. Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, on November 2nd, is a day where many people from Mexico and Central America commemorate the lives of the departed. This tradition can be traced back to Mesoamerican times, and it blends indigenous practices with Spanish Catholic customs. The American Psychological Association defines grief as, quote, the anguish experienced after significant loss, unquote. As Dia de los Muertos was approaching, it allowed me to reflect on the role that grief plays in our lives. Grieving can feel incredibly isolating, yet it never comes alone. A wide range of emotions often accompanies grief: confusion, disbelief, denial, anger, sadness, guilt. One of my most visceral memories of grief was tangled with guilt as I bore witness to the deep sadness that my dad faced as he had to say goodbye from afar to his grandma. My great-grandmother raised my dad. She passed away in 2006 in Mexico. He had to confront the reality of choosing between paying his last respects to the person who raised him and staying in this country to raise his family. Yet when I was experiencing this as a teenage girl, I had no words. Silence and suppressed emotions were my way to cope with the harsh reality of losing someone and having grief from afar, where I could not say a last goodbye. Being trained as a dancer, I learned at a young age that the body can endure pain and move through it. Yet losing my Nana and witnessing my dad in such a vulnerable stage when he learned that the woman who raised him had transcended this earth, it broke me. As a teenager, I could not truly comprehend the complexity of grief. As a daughter, I cried in silence to show what I thought about how I should support my grieving dad. Grief is a universal human experience. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many had to experience grieving loved ones without attending funerals, holding loved ones, or following important traditions and rituals similar to what many mixed immigration status families experienced for years. According to the Pew Research Center, 7.5 million U.S. households included unauthorized immigrants in 2023. They represented 5.6% of the 133 million households nationwide. In a recent study, Arizona State University's assistant professor, Rafael Martinez, alongside a team of scholars, published research where they studied the connection between funerals and mental health among Latino adults. Dr. Martinez stated that, quote, for undocumented immigrants, the inability to travel to their home countries to attend funerals added another layer of pain. And for many, the fear of deportation or discrimination in healthcare settings made it difficult to seek help. Grief did not happen in a vacuum. It was shaped by systemic inequities, unquote. The words of Dr. Martinez are more relevant than ever as we continue to see the human cost of congressional gridlock on immigration. Despite the gridlock, something I've been reflecting on in my experience with grief is that gratitude is intimately interconnected. I've learned that the incredible pain that comes with it stems from humans' remarkable capacity to love. As you drive through the bright Arizona sunlight and see the deep orange of marigolds this fall, I invite you to transform the hollowness of isolation into the fullness of belonging. We have an opportunity to see the humanity of our neighbors, regardless of our differences, whether immigration status or religious background. Let's come together. Let's collectively grieve and make space for our shared humanity, as that is the legacy that we will leave for our descendants. And that was Reyna Montoya's opinion piece, When Migration, Grief, and Culture Meet. Our next opinion piece was written by Dace, D-A-C-E, POTUS, P-O-T-A-S. Dace is an opinion columnist for the USA Today and is a graduate of DePaul University with a degree in political science. His opinion piece is entitled, Trump's Strikes on Drug Boats Are Smart Policy, but Unconstitutional. Here's what he wrote. President Donald Trump is ramping up his campaign against suspected Venezuelan drug boats. As of October 29th, the U.S. military has reported destroying at least 13 vessels, killing 57 people, and leaving several survivors. The administration has justified these strikes under suspicious pretenses, and Americans should worry about the expansion of presidential war powers that Trump's actions signal. Now, while I am favorable toward the use of overwhelming force against drug traffickers as a deterrent, Trump is likely violating the Constitution in executing supposed narcotic smugglers. All the while, Congress is idle, completely unwilling to reassert its authority in just about anything. Blowing up drug boats headed for the United States is awesome, and a policy that I would wholly endorse if it were done legally. What better deterrent can you come up with for drug runners than the possibility of a fiery death from above? However, there are some serious questions about Trump's airstrikes off the coast of Venezuela. It's unclear what the legal rationale for these strikes is. The president has done little to prove that these strikes are, in fact, against drug traffickers, or that the boats are ultimately headed for the United States. For the sake of this argument, I'm going to assume that the vessels Trump is striking are actually carrying narcotics. Trump and the rest of his administration have more or less justified these strikes by claiming that the boats are run by narco-terrorists. That's a description designed to give the administration cover. This declaration also allows Trump to violate due process for these individuals, killing without the need to provide evidence of their wrongdoing. The administration has likened these strikes to those against Al-Qaeda jihadists, which isn't a bad political defense, given President Barack Obama's love for drone-striking terrorists. Yet it offers little in a way of a legal rationale. Trafficking drugs that kill Americans is a heinous crime, but it is not terrorism. The Constitution gives the president authority to address imminent threats, and Congress has given the president broad authority to address terroristic threats under the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, which was passed in response to the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. Now, drug boats pose neither an imminent threat in the traditional understanding of the term, nor do they constitute a terrorist threat. Legal experts have clearly explained the distinct difference between drug trafficking and terrorism. Trump has this view of the law, treating it as a construct full of loopholes for him to exploit. He tries to stretch statutes to mean things they are not intended to mean. In his view, he simply calls something by the name of another thing. Then the rules that apply to one must apply to both. If he calls drug traffickers terrorists, he can bomb them into oblivion. As I have written before, if he calls illegal immigration an invasion, he can violate due process. If he claims, without merit, that a trickle of fentanyl over the Canadian border is an emergency, he can use emergency powers. Now, all of this is enabled by a dormant Congress that has no interest in reasserting itself as a proper lawmaking branch of government. Despite a looming second Senate vote on bombing alleged drug boats, House Speaker Mike Johnson, the Republican from Louisiana, is unlikely to take up such a limitation on the president's authority, even if it were to pass the Senate. I wish we had a functioning Congress that was regularly clarifying the scope of delegated executive power. But whether the current attitude on Capitol Hill is apathy or fear or sloth or malice, lawmakers certainly are not in the business of reasserting their authority anytime soon. Instead, the legislative branch would much rather sit back and watch Trump run afoul of the Constitution than have to tell him no. Every single member of Congress watching all of this happen, pretending as if they are on the sidelines, it is a violation of the oath that they have taken. And that is the opinion piece, Trump strikes on drug boats are smart policy, but unconstitutional. Well, I think we have time for an opinion piece written by people like you and me in the section of the paper called The Letters to the Editor. This letter goes like this. Dear citizens of Arizona, I feel the homeless situation in Arizona and across America could be resolved with the right plan in place. The way homeless people are currently being treated is shameful. Human beings are being treated like trash. They are not seen, heard, or understood. How can anyone say they want to live on the streets? That is stupid and uncaring to say such a thing. In order to help people who are so-called homeless, you have to see the person. Most people who are not living on the streets do not see those who are. For example, I have helped people living on the street in parks across from churches, and nobody stops. The well-to-do don't care. The athletes don't care. If there are 20 million churches in America and 10 million people living on the streets, is it too much to ask for every church to step up? Instead of people listening to the same regurgitated message, how about spending time on supporting a person or family? Do church without walls. Signed, Arnold Byram, in Peoria. Well, we're at 45 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. We're going to begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are you pushing someone away? An old romantic wound reopens. Think hard before you self-sabotage. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, your confidence weakens. A little self-love is in order. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, a romantic disappointment has you in your feelings. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, a loved one overlooks an important achievement. That doesn't mean you cannot celebrate it. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, you are regretting sharing what you really think about an edgy subject. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, your mind is hijacked by a worst-case scenario. For Libra, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, are you settling for less in the love department? You are doubting that you can do better. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, are you wishing you could be more useful? You are putting yourself down before others can. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, is this romance hitting the right notes? Your head might be more in it than your heart. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, cracks in your cool demeanor point to an unresolved childhood wound today. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, are you tripping over your words? An attempt to connect with a new acquaintance falls flat. Finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Getting serious with a lover gives you pause. You want intimacy, but fear it too. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I have a group of wonderful women friends that I have known for decades. We get together monthly for dinner and drinks at a local restaurant. The location is generally left up to whoever has a birthday that month, and it usually varies among three choices. Occasionally, I know I bow out if they choose a restaurant that caters to a local creep. This man, Bob, has never been charged with an offense, but I was one of his victims 20 years ago, weeks after my first husband's death. Bob broke into my home and stole items from my husband's office. I was there at the time. He came into my bedroom while I was dressing. I screamed at him, and he responded that I hadn't heard him knocking at the door, and he wanted to make sure I was all right. I have no ties to Bob, but my friends do. All of them are aware of his actions and reputation. So is the owner of his nightly hangout. But Bob is a jolly bar guy and buys drinks, so everyone, except me, is okay with it. I get PTSD at the thought of attending one of our dinners when this particular establishment is chosen, so I usually skip those nights. A few of the women in my friends group have told me I need to just get over it, but I can't. Do you have any advice on how to handle this? Signed, Victim in Wisconsin. And Abby responds, Dear Victim, I'm sorry for what happened that day. Although Bob didn't touch you, the terror was real. I do have a couple of suggestions regarding how to handle this. The first is to continue refusing to attend birthday celebrations that might expose you to the man who broke into your home. Did you file a police report? And also, I think you should think twice about how wonderful a woman friend is who would choose that restaurant for her party. If your PTSD continues, consider consulting a licensed mental health professional who specializes in it. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I've been engaged 3 times, and each time something happened and caused the engagements to be broken. I'm 38 now. I'm not sure if marriage is ever going to happen, but it's something I have looked forward to and is a dream of mine. However, the more I think about it and how things are these days, I can't help but wonder if it will ever happen for me. What do you think I should do? Keep hoping or put marriage on the back burner? Signed, Hoping Against Hope in Indiana. And Abby responds, Dear Hoping, sit down and ask yourself what went wrong with each of your engagements so it won't be repeated. Then begin plotting out a different life for yourself, an interesting one filled with activities, adventures, and the pursuit of subjects that interest you. This can become your gratifying reality. If you do, it will expose you to people you might not otherwise meet. Of course, you can keep hoping for marriage, but your chances of finding what you're looking for will be better if you become more active than if you are preoccupying yourself with this dream. Don't forget, you can contact Abigail Van Buren in 2 ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Now it's time for some comics. In the comic strip Zits, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borkman, Jeremy and his mom are in the kitchen, and she's got the grocery bags on the table, and he's putting the groceries away in the shelves. And in the first frame, she says, top shelf, as he reaches up to put a box up on the top shelf. And he says, Mom, I need a loan. And the next frame, she hands him a can, and she says, a loan for what? And he says, for money. And he's putting the can away, and the next frame, she goes, well, money for what? He says, to spend. And then she goes, well, to spend on what? And he goes, well, on things, I guess. At which point, in the last frame, she's run out of the kitchen. And he goes, how much more specific can I get? And that was Zits. Then we've got the comic strip Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. And in the first frame, Sergeant Snorkel sitting at his desk, and all of a sudden, whoomp! And he just kind of flies up out of his chair and falls back down into it. And he looks out the window going, what's going on? And then another one, whoomp! And he goes flying out of his chair. So he goes to the window and he says, what are you doing out here, Beetle? And Beetle's sitting in a excavator or a backhoe operator. And he says, I'm tamping down the dirt over the ditch that I dug. And Sergeant Snorkel yells out the window, well, stop tamping. And that was Beetle Bailey. Then we've got Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall. Uh-oh. Dagwood's at the office. He goes in to see Mr. Dithers. And Mr. Dithers is sitting at his desk, and Dagwood says, Boss, I made a little mistake on that contract I handed you yesterday. Mr. Dithers goes, well, how little? And Dagwood says, I typed 1,000 instead of 100. 1,000? Bumstead, you count on your... You to double-check, I count on you to double-check every single number to make sure it's right on the money. I'm paying you to pay close attention to every expensive detail. And Dagwood says, I know, boss. At least the mistake is in favor of Dithers and company. Well, Mr. Dithers sits back down, turns back around to his desk, and says, no worries, Bumstead. These things happen. And that was Blondie. In the comic strip Pickles, that's drawn by Brian Crane. In the first frame, the grandson, Nelson, is walking with a friend, and they're approaching the front door, and then he says, my grandma's house is like a museum. In the next frame, they're looking at a sewing machine. They've got lots of really, really old stuff. In the next frame, he points to a telephone. says, "This used to be a telephone." And the other kid says, "No way." And then in the next frame, they're walking out into the next room, and Nelson says, "Some of this stuff's so old and dusty, I don't even know what it is." And then in the next frame, his friend says, "Hey, what is that thing over there?" In the last frame, we see Earl sitting in his easy chair, and Nelson says, "Nope, that's my grandpa." And that was Pickles. And in the comic strip Foxtrot, that's drawn by Bill Amend, Peter comes in and says to his mom, "Ugh, I'm so tired, and it's only 7:30 p.m. And his mom says, "You do know why that is, right? Daylight saving time just ended. All the clocks were turned back an hour. Your body thinks it's 8:30. You seriously didn't realize that?" Oh, silly Peter. He leaves the kitchen with mom, and he goes into the living room, and there's his younger brother. And his younger brother says, "I'm impressed that you didn't explain that it's actually because you were out until 4 a.m. last night." And his older brother says, "I'd rather be silly Peter than grounded Peter." And that was Foxtrot. Well, I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sunsounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, the first Sunday in November, November 2nd, 2025. I hope you have a great day today, and I hope you keep on listening. Bye for now.